Welcome back, everyone. I haven't edited the slide, but homework one, how'd that go for everybody?
It was a little rough at first, but got through it.
Eventually decided that's all stuff you do now?
Yeah, just took a little bit of remembering. A little math that I haven't done forever.
Good.
That's probably a good thing.
Good to refresh on those things. Any other thoughts? What one?
I hope most of them are like problem four.
They will be.
That's good. That was the best one.
And in a couple of weeks, they'll probably tell me I wish less of them were like problem four. that'll be it for review. Like those first three problems, just meant to make you go back and remember, rather than circuit analysis and differential equations a little bit before we dive into alternative techniques to look at these things. But as we've talked about with this motivation, we're going to be looking at resonant circuits a lot in this class. Most of the homework problems from here on out are going to be power electronics, and they're going to be like problem four, and there's more often than not a bit of a design slant to it. It's not just here's the numbers, solve for this. That's okay. Then think about what's the optimal switching frequency, what's the optimal voltage here. Can you make it smaller? These kinds of things. So a little bit of a design element to it. We're always based on the analysis we talked about in class. I will post homework two shortly after class. I'm a little bit behind on lectures, so I recommend you wait until after Monday's lecture to dive into it deeply, as we'll cover some of the equations needed in it on Monday.
Oh.
But it'll be due next Friday. Other questions? Okay, well then we'll dive back in. So last time, we really finished up all the cases I wanted to show on this example boost converter. I started looking into DCM operation. It was our first kind of implementation into soft switching. We got to DCM really simply by just decreasing the inductance down to 4.6 microhenries. Okay. That number comes from some calculations and some other places, but for the moment, all we did was decrease it so that we get a little bit more than 100% current ripple, and saw that the result of that was a significant increase in efficiency. Reason being that we recover all that energy that was stored in really the switch node capacity. Talked about it's the drain to source capacitance of the MOSFET, but also incorporates any other parasitic capacitances between the switch node and any other largely DC node. Okay. So energy stored in all those capacitances, when we let the inductor current resonate past zero, get this resonant circuit that pulls all that energy back out. We get it out of those caps before we turn on the MOSFET, then we can turn on the MOSFET with what we call zero voltage switching, really low energy loss during that turn on transition. Then went through a couple of quick cases just to show, okay, even going further, DCM had a problem at light load. It also has the diode forward voltage as a larger conduction loss, so we can replace that with a FET. That'll give us the ability to have negative current. It was a little bit easier, constant switching frequency light load operation. And it'll eliminate that VF loss of the diode and give us a little bit lower conduction losses. But as we put in a synchronous implementation, two different actively controlled switches, two transistors that we're supplying gate drive signals to tell them when to turn on. We need to be real careful in generating those gate drive signals to make sure we have dead times, so they don't short out anything. So assuming we do that correctly, then we can keep this nice zero voltage switching behavior, but also allow at light load and the current to go negative to bring the average down, keep the same kind of nice, nearly triangular wave operation, but adjust the power level just by the DC offset of that inductor current. And then the last one that we mentioned just briefly, this quasi-resonant converter, is the ZVS quasi-resonant implementation of the boost converter. We incorporated now a couple of resonant elements. Here we kind of make a distinction. Now we're really talking about having separate elements that resonate and separate elements that are filter elements, so like this inductor and this capacitor are more like a intro to power electronics EC481 inductor and capacitor. It's got really small ripple, nearly constant current in the inductor, constant voltage on the capacitor. And then these two circled in red are our resonant elements that are going to have really huge ripple, small ripple, and averaging approximations aren't going to apply to those. Goal of this implementation is to get a couple things. First, integrate those parasitics into the operation. Because no matter what we do when we build a real converter, we're always going to have some capacitance here from the device or any PCB layout parasitics, some inductance here. Same thing from the package of the transistor or any layout traces that we use. So can we integrate those into operation? And can we do so in a way that makes the switching of, in this case, this transistor much more favorable, much more low loss switching? And then briefly showed the waveforms here. Happens as we get these large kind of high peak stress, half sine wave resonances in the diode current and the transistor voltage. But as a result, we get really nice switching behaviors, because when the FET turns off, here, voltage isn't rising very quickly. So we actually have kind of some tolerance error there in timings of things. If we turned it off a little bit late, if we turn it on a little bit early, we don't have this near vertical spike in the voltage on the FET that could cause us to have a lot of switching loss. Okay. These types of quasi-resonant or fully resonant implementations are more important as we go to higher and higher frequency.
Okay. Yeah. About the quasi-resonant, I noticed that the sizes though were fairly large in comparison to what we had for even the soft switching. Mm-hmm. They're in micro. The other one for, I mean, it's still a significant size difference.
Yeah, and that's just tuning here. Okay, so we could run it up at a megahertz and then bother to tune it up there. And we would be able to drop the size of that inductor. Here was just showing we could go all the way back to almost the low switching frequency we had here, gotcha. Or we can run it higher. So a more typical implementation would definitely be something like megahertz or above. We get this down in the nanohenries. Okay. Capacitance would be
cool.
You know, 10 times smaller.
I was like, that's kind of defeats the purpose of what you're trying to do with the
so. Yeah.
It makes sense.
In terms of what we were trying to do, you know, we talked about smaller inductance being helpful and that it makes the thing smaller, but it wasn't really a design goal here other than to kind of discuss through some options and see where we can improve things or not. You know, if this was real, and like I said last time, this 99.96 is never going to be even close to possible. It's just because in simulation, all the losses have basically been removed that are actually included in the simulation. You probably do want to tolerate those larger inductors. So things 100% efficient. Or practically, there's always going to be some trade-off between size and efficiency. Some other trade-off as well. With that, just some concluding remarks. I want to talk a little bit about how we look at resonant circuits. Just to set the stage for this course. Coming from an introductory power electronics course like EC481, you see a circuit like this, which might be the output filter of a buck converter. And you say, okay, EC481, how do I approach this? Well, I apply small ripple, say IL of T, approximately IL, label IL of T, and V out of T, approximately capital V. And then with that in mind, and that there's some switching action here on VN, I can go through and apply things like volt second balance and cap charge balance and model the averages just by these steady state averaging conditions. Okay. This sort of stuff is not going to generally apply in this class. When 581, I was just mentioning for this resonant thing, we're going to have to be a little bit more intelligent about where we can apply these types of assumptions. So things like the output capacitor in a DC to DC converter, we'll generally be able to say small ripple applies to that. It's supposed to be a DC to DC converter. The output voltage should be nearly DC. It better have small ripple. Okay. So almost always be designing an output capacitor that's large enough such that small ripple applies. In this case, this input inductor has relatively small ripple. Small ripple assumptions and averaging can work okay on it. But these two resonant elements, if you apply small ripple and averaging, you just lose the entire behavior of what they're doing. Okay? So all these elements that are having some significant resonance, we're going to have to actually analyze that resonance. We can't just average it away. Okay? So we're going to have to be real careful about where we make these kinds of assumptions on small ripple or averaging. And when we can't, we're going to have to drop back to full circuit analysis. Say, okay, we're going to take this circuit and we're going to run our transient analysis. And we're going to get some sort of differential equation, something like LC V squared V out dt squared plus L over R dV out dt plus V out minus V in equals zero, and go through and solve this. Then we may have to do so across multiple different switching intervals as we switch some devices, and the configuration of the circuit changes. We need to go through and solve that differential equation to figure out how these waveforms progress because that resonance is significant. We're going to do this. We're going to develop tools to make it a little bit simpler and a little bit faster, kind of recognizing some patterns to be able to not have to actually go to the full DPQs, but still get the full solution to the differential equation. Okay, so we go through and solve that. We'll develop some new techniques in the class. Techniques. I wanted you to go back and look at a little bit on the homework, but we'll give you some help before you really have to dive in deep on this. Is I comment all of electrical engineering. Just taught circuits two last semester. That makes you realize that you have circuits one, where you learn how circuits work and all the equations that go into them. And then basically all circuit analysis from then on is, hey, how do we not have to do the DPQs? Like, we already know how to do this, taking DPQs, we know KVL, KCL, and the elementary equations. Can I just make it so I don't have to actually solve the DPQs? And that's phasors and Laplace and all this stuff that makes it easier. So we'll give you more of that. Like, here's hate. Okay. And then I just want to comment on kind of in the frequency domain, what's the difference between where we were with filter elements and where we're going to be in 581? So I'm going to look at a Bode plot of transfer function of this circuit in dB versus the log frequency axis. Transfer function H of S will define as here small signal output voltage, the out hat over V in hat. Things completely linear as I've drawn it, so that small signal assumption isn't so important, but generally when we have different elements in there, it's going to matter. For this circuit, that should look like 1 over S squared LC plus SL over R plus 1. Same thing as the differential equation we wrote on the previous slide. And then kind of our standard form, the last time, we'll say omega naught is 1 over root LC. Characteristic impedance, root L over R, and our Q is R over R naught. That'll give us the main characteristics of this Bode plot. And then, if I wanted to sketch a Bode plot of this, I know this LC is going to look like a low-pass filter. No zeros, a double pole, making some assumptions that L and C are large and R is not so small as to damp this out significantly. We'll get some kind of resonance. So I'm on units of hertz over here. So I'll call this F naught, just omega naught, but in hertz. My Bode plot magnitude should look something like flat here, minus 20 dB per decade, or excuse me, 40 dB per decade here, after the double pull. And in the vicinity of F naught, I'm going to have this Q. I'm going to have a bump that goes up to a height of Q and dB, and depending on the exact values of these passive elements and resistance, we get a different height out of that. Here should be U and dB, height of a bump. Okay. So, important thing in designing, if this is again some switching converter and I'm analyzing the output filter of a buck converter. Important thing about this filter is how it interacts with the switching behaviors of the converter. Again, if I'm designing a small ripple type filter, a traditional PWM 481 type buck converter, I want to put my switching frequency somewhere out here. We're way above this resonance, somewhere where all of my frequency components at the switching frequency and above see a big attenuation through this filter, and they're all blocked. By the time I get to the output, none of this switching frequency and higher harmonic stuff remain. It's attenuated down to very small magnitude. And what I'm left with is just the low frequency components, DC and steady state. And if I'm controlling it, some small low frequency transient based on my control. We design that way, where at our switching frequency we have all this attenuation, then we should be able to apply things like small ripple approximation and averaging, because the thing is really filtering all of this out. Here, when we start looking at resonant elements, it means we're going to be designing our switching frequency somewhere here, somewhere in the vicinity. We'll be switching close to the resonance of this circuit. Depending on the design, some will be right on it. Some will be switching a little bit slower or a little bit faster based on the waveforms that we're hoping to get. If it's just resonant for part of the period, then we want that resonance to be faster than the switching frequency so we can get it done during just one interval of the period, right? For example, the waveforms here. So one switching period is longer than, if you can imagine, the second half of the sinusoid and the inductor or the diode current. Will be a higher frequency than the switching frequency, right? So that we can get that half resonance done in just one portion of the period. But on the same order of magnitude, right? Maybe 2, 3, 5 times as much, we're gonna place the switching frequency right in the vicinity of that resonance. Okay. We look then at some behavior like this, look in the time domain, what do these features correspond to? Plot V out of T versus T. I'm gonna say this is a step response, or just some step in the input voltage. That's the further the unit step response, go from 0 to 1. A low pass filter, low frequency gain is unity, so I know eventually I should end up at a value of 1. I'm going to start 0 on the output voltage, and I'm going to end up for infinite time at 1. How I get there depends on these features of the circuit, okay? Largely on where's F naught and what's the magnitude of Q. Assume F naught is some constant. As I vary Q around, if I have really low Q, I expect to see waveforms that look like this for the overdamped case. The Q much less than 0.5. If I go higher in Q, Q is a half, I should be close to a critically damped case. Something like this, where I've got a little bit of overshoot. And for Q much greater than 0.5, I expect to see some significant ringing going on. Decaying down. U has a few different interpretations. So it is the height of this bump on the Bode plot up here at the top. Here does tell us more information about the ringing. How quick am I going to decay as I'm ringing out in this transient response? Also, more generally, Q is the quality factor. It tells us information about how much energy is lost per period of a resonance. When we are designing controls, we want to have closed loop transfer functions where Q is very low. We limit the amount of ringing. Things steady out very quickly. Right? This red case might be a good design if this is my closed loop transfer function, my controlled power converter. I change the reference, it goes to the new value quickly with minimal overshoot, minimal ringing. Okay? Start designing resonance circuits as part of the power converter, we want Q to be as high as possible. Getting Q down indicates that there's more energy loss. So here we're going to be trying to have zero energy loss in the actual power converter operation. We're going to like really high Q resonances. Okay? Q is going to be limited in our circuit only by parasitic resistance. That's another thing. Okay. So that kind of link this to what we've been looking at. So we have been looking at this boost converter. Put the diode in here. Okay, and let's just talk about, say, the MOSFET shut off. I drop the gate drive waveform, shut off the MOSFET, conductor current is flowing this way, and I expect to see a waveform from what we just looked at for the switch node voltage. Starts down when the MOSFET's off, then I shut it off, and it kind of comes up like this and goes to V out. Right. Kind of waveforms we saw in really all of the simulations except for that last resonant one for the shut off of the MOSFET. Okay. When we went away from our ideal approximation, this was no longer a perfect vertical line. It took some time to get there. The time was dictated by how long it takes for the inductor current to charge the drain to source capacitor. Okay. Where does this dynamic come from? We figure out what's actually going on during that time that the voltage is rising. Well, what we're left with is just as the diode is off, when the MOSFET shuts off, we've got a resonant circuit between L and CDF. And this waveform that we're seeing is actually a small part of a giant sinusoidal transient response. If I just shut the MOSFET off and never turn the MOSFET or diode back on again, see this huge sinusoidal ringing out. And depending on the initial conditions and the element values, this thing can be taller and narrower. In this case, it's much bigger, which is why we get these relatively fast transitions. On the opposite transition, you turn on to the MOSFET and we're soft switching, we're getting almost a full half period of the sinusoidal. Point being that during all of these transitions, what we're actually looking at is large sinusoidal waveforms. We start increasing the values of the passes and getting more towards our small ripple design. We're only seeing a very small portion of that sinusoid, so everything that we have where we think we have straight line ripple, triangular inductor current ripple, those are just tiny little pieces of a huge sinusoid. Yeah, sure.
I think you said this earlier, but that means that we're
We want Q very large, almost no damping for the kind of circuits we're going to analyze, which are a switching interval within the converter, right? So what we want is no energy loss, right? We want things to be extremely efficient, lose very little energy over this time. We were never going to lose zero energy, but we certainly don't want things like an overdamp case where before we can even finish half a resonant period, all the energy is lost.
And if it was like overdamped, your BS switching voltage would it would essentially have a lower PBD.
So yeah, instead of being this full sinusoid, it would die out if we were fully overdamped. The actual steady state solution of this, and we'll get into more specific analysis of this specific and other converters like it. But I mean, if we were really fully overdamped, be really bad design. What you'd see is something like this. In this case, based on the dynamics of it, the steady state solution will be lower. Well, not all the way down to zero, excuse me. Would kind of come up here and stop at VG. Like shut everything off in steady state. This voltage is going to be VG. Put zero voltage on the inductor and let me steady out. If I was really overdamped, it would only come up this high. And then whenever I turn on the diode would never turn on, but if it was the synchronous implementation, when I turned it on, it short out the remainder of that voltage on the high side FET. So it would come up and just stay here until something else happens. Okay. One thing to be in these underdamped cases is not really going to be a separate thing that we have to design in. It's going to be just kind of part of how we're designing this converter and where we end up as what's the damping in that remaining circuit. You got the input source, the inductor, and the drain to source capacitor. Say the FET and diode are off. So I've just got these three elements. The damping that remains comes from the resistance of the inductor, any trace resistance. Those are things that we're always going to be trying to minimize in a power converter anyway. Right? Okay. Other questions? Well, that's kind of where we're going to sit in this class. We'll be looking very closely at soft switching. Just a summary in terms of introduction. By doing these types of things, reducing the switching losses, using things like zero voltage switching or other soft switching techniques, we get the advantage of reducing switching loss, which allows us to go up to higher switching frequency. Those are potentially good things. Higher switching frequency, like I've mentioned, is never really a good thing on its own, but if it allows you to make the converter smaller or make your control bandwidth wider, that can be a good thing. Part of the mechanisms that allow us to do this are incorporating parasitic elements into the circuit. Things that are always in there, like drain to source capacitance or parasitic drain inductance. But instead of treating them as parasitics that just cause loss, we're kind of integrating them into the designed operation of the converter. Another that needs some work to be leveraged correctly is lower EMI, but by dropping down the DVDT and getting rid of some of these very vertical switching actions, which in a real converter with parasitics always result in ringing, overstressing, we can reduce the EMI of the system. It can be important if it's integrated into some larger application. Disadvantages, you know, have increased stresses, both can be off-state voltage of FETs, so higher peak voltage stress, or higher peak and RMS current values throughout. So we're going to be trading off often some reduction in switching loss and get some increase in conduction loss to get there. And then this is the one that we're going to get rid of by the end of the course. It's a little bit harder to model and design around. By the time you get out of this course, should be no problem. Next couple slides, I just want to talk about some of the limitations of this. So if this allows us to kind of piece by piece reduce switching losses, why don't we design everything at a gigahertz and have passives that are picofarads and picohenries and everything is microscopic? So as we push higher in switching frequency, as we push for smaller designs, eventually we're going to run into some of these other limitations. And power electronics, switching analysis is like a, you know, peeling away layers of an onion. As soon as you get rid of the CDS loss, you can push far enough until the next loss mechanism pops up. And you get rid of that one, and you can push a little further until the next one pops up. But there's always something else that's going to constrain your design. So a few of those potential candidates, first, a gate drive. So this is just a model of what would be the gate of the FET. So here's my FET internal to the gate. We've got this gate source capacitance and then some internal gate resistance. Even if you don't put any external, there is some resistance just at the metal or polysilicon traces inside that FET that are used to create the gate. And then this here is my gate driver. Typical implementation of a gate driver for FET is just a couple of transistors. More often than not as an inverter, but a couple of transistor devices, and I turn on S1 if I want to bring the gate high, I turn on S2 if I want to bring it low. Okay, then typical gate drive. These would kind of come back and be a bunch more stages of this. It's all cascaded. Idea being we need pretty low resistance transistors, S1 and S2, to provide high current to charge the FET. Because those FETs are big, it means they're hard to drive, so we need a slightly smaller pair of FETs one step behind here, and then a slightly smaller pair of FETs to drive those, and then a slightly smaller pair of FETs to drive those, and eventually get back to small enough FETs that a DSP or FPGA can drive. That's the internals of the gate driver.
RG is a parasitic resistance.
RG is, in this case, I'm showing it as the parasitic resistance. Now, you know, you might put your own external resistance for various reasons, but here in the limit, even if I put no external resistance in the gate, there still is whatever's inside the FET. And there still is in this loop, whatever the R on of these devices is. Okay. So even if I don't add any resistance, there's still a resistance in this gate drive loop that is the internal resistance of the FET and the power FET and the on resistance of these two driving FETs. That'll limit how fast I can turn this thing on or off. So that'll limit some of the statements and assumptions I made in the previous analysis where I said, okay, when we look at the strain to source capacitance, let's assume the FET just switches instantaneously. It can't. It's got some RC circuit here, and it's going to take some time to switch. We'll look at that in some detail in the coming lectures. And the other limitation here, more fundamentally, is as we switch faster and faster, I'm going to lose more energy just from this gate driver. Okay, just to get the FET to turn on, I have to get 1/2 CGS times whatever my drive voltage is onto this capacitor. And then to get the FET to turn off, we'll turn on this device and short that out and dissipate it on RG and the R on S2. Similar really to the CDS that we were just looking at, but here I don't have a resonant circuit. There are some resonant gate drives, but they're not commonly employed. So in a traditional design, I am losing that gate charge energy every switching period. And as I go to higher and higher switching frequencies, that power loss becomes more significant. So this is off of the data sheet of some commercial gate driver saying, for some assumed gate voltage and input capacitance of the FET, switching losses from the gate driver itself are going to go up with frequency proportional to it. Second curve is additional losses from bootstrapping the high side supply for a 2-FET driver. But fundamentally, we do have these gate drive losses, and they're going to go up, so we're not going to be able to switch as fast as we'd like with that considered. Many designs kind of higher power and lower switching frequencies. These are completely negligible. We push up to higher and higher switching frequencies. Eventually, they come into play. The gate loss is whatever energy we put into the gate to get the FET to turn on times FS, because we end up dissipating all of that energy when we shut the FET off in this type of gate drive. This one we kind of touched on as we went through and talked about different candidate designs for our boost converter. But here is a slightly different set of operating parameters, a higher voltage gate driver. Does that pop down? Is that a cat? And the point I'm making here is that, okay, as we push up in switching frequency, this kind of reflection of trying to obtain soft switching, causing us to have higher peak current stresses, gets worse and worse. Okay, so what this is a switch node voltage and inductor current in a boost converter. This is an experimental one, so got some waveforms. It was running at 400 volts out, about 300 watts. And the time axis here is normalized. So it always goes just zero to TF. But for these three curves, I'm changing the switching frequency. Okay. So this 2 megahertz curve, obviously this whole period happens in a shorter amount of time. Still one TS, but that TS is smaller. Okay. Okay, you see all of them are designed to have these nice soft switching waveforms. See the inductor current goes negative, and then the voltage on the switch node drops in this resonant manner down to zero. The inductance changes a little bit for each of these designs, tune them for this nice operation. But as you go to higher switching frequency, just that interval that it takes to get the switch node voltage from its peak down to zero starts taking a higher and higher percentage of the period. Okay. And during that interval, because all of my devices are off and I'm not delivering any power to the output, means I'm having more and more time in the period where I'm not delivering any power. So during the intervals where I am delivering power, I'm gonna have to go to a higher current to get the same amount of power to the output, the same average power in it. And that's why you see at the higher switching frequency, 2 megahertz, I have the highest peak current stresses, even though all three of these are the same power. Okay. As FS goes up, I'm gonna end up increasing with the same type of design, same type of operating waveforms, my peak current stresses, because I'm spending more and more time within one period switching. Okay. My switching intervals become, instead of 0.1% of the period, they're now 10-15% of the period. And you can kind of see that in some of these experimental waveforms. This whole period is just the transition between the diode turning off and the MOSFET turning on. It's maybe 15 to 20% of the period is just one of the switching transitions. Traditionally say that's 0% of the period. That should be instantaneous in a small ripple design. Okay. So as FS increases, the ratio of my, call it, dead time to switching period increases, a time where my switching is happening, is a higher percentage of the overall switching period, which then invariably reflects as higher current stresses. Generally, IL peak increases so that we can deliver the same amount of power in a shorter amount of time. Okay. Make sense?
Dr. Kastanet.
Okay, next one I'll talk about, I'm pulling some reference from ETH down here, talking about some of their design optimizations for a sample converter. They're saying, let's vary the switching frequency and look at the volume or power density of the converter. What you see is as you go to higher and higher switching frequencies, things like your filter elements get smaller, which we've talked about, right? Higher switching frequency, smaller inductor, that should make the whole thing smaller volume. Doing common mode noise filtering, it's more or less the same everywhere, unless you do a switching frequency. The big problem is here, what about your cooling system? Initially, as you go to higher switching frequency, start doing things like decreasing the ripple on your inductor current, decreasing its core loss, you'll see some advantage in terms of efficiency. But if you're not changing designs and changing topologies, as you keep going to higher switching frequency, eventually switching losses kill you. And this is all, in this case, for one type of converter. It's not saying start at hard switching, then jump to soft switching, then change the operating. It's kind of just one consistent way of designing it. So you always end up with some island here in the middle when you're considering a holistic design of the converter. It's some advantage for a while of going to higher switching frequency, but if you keep trying to push it higher and higher, eventually whatever remaining switching losses you have get big enough, and in order to keep the thing from overheating, you need a big cooler because the efficiency starts dropping. Okay.
What's the efficiency?
Differential mode and comm mode filter, assuming it has to be EMI compliant. Make sure you design your filters to achieve that. So not really getting into exactly what their application is and what they're trying to achieve, but just trying to talk about the general effect here. You'll see that often in power electronics, there's these Pareto optimization fronts, things like efficiency versus power density. So watts per liter or centimeter square, this is power density. Really just a measure of size for one design where you know how much output power you need, but we talk about power density because that way efficiency and power density are both things we want to maximize. We talk about size and we want to maximize one, minimize the other. Right. So for a given, I'm trying to call it a technology node or some kind of way that you're going to design this converter. Say, okay, it's going to be a CCM buck with 10% ripple. If I start changing switching frequency around some at a lower limit, I should have really high efficiency, but I need huge filter elements. And as I start increasing switching frequency, I should see switching losses go up, but my filter element sizes go down, so my power density goes up. Okay. And that'll continue out to some point. And moving this direction is increasing switching frequency. Continue out to some point where my efficiency starts dropping so much that I need to start adding more fans to it in a bigger heat sink, and it actually starts making it bigger and my power density drops. Main of the curve looks something like that for one kind of approach to designing this converter. Okay, it is everything on this solid portion of the curve is what we call Pareto optimal. Call this whole curve a Pareto front. Yeah, Pareto, come up with this. And the idea with Pareto optimal is you're looking at two different metrics, and when they're not comparable, I can't tell you how many efficiencies are worth one power density, then you can't really make a distinction of which of these designs is best. Right? It just depends on how much you care about efficiency versus power density. Anything on this upper curve, if I want my power density to go up, I need my efficiency to go down. So it's always a trade-off between the two. Anything down here is not. I can say at this point, I can keep the same power density and get a higher efficiency just by decreasing the switching frequency back around the knee of this curve. I should have designed here instead. You'll see these things a lot in power electronics. Sometimes we may care about different metrics, maybe efficiency versus cost, or efficiency versus volume, specific power, other things. But when you have these dissimilar metrics, the most general way to optimize is to say anything on the Pareto front is in some sense optimal. To select a specific design in here, you have to tell me what's your application and how much do you care about the size versus the efficiency? Which one do you care about more? Or you want to design. Okay. Then what I should generally see is if I start changing that technology, instead of my CCM buck, I'm now going to design this DCM zero voltage switching thing. I'll get a different curve with the same shape, but it's kind of expanded and compressed and contracted. So I might have like this be my curve for a soft switching converter, and the blue be my curve for a hard switching converter. Okay. Possible that it can be just a purely better design that purely consumes this other one. More often than not, they kind of overlap, to allow me to get out to smaller size at a comparable efficiency, but I can't quite get that peak efficiency at 10 kilohertz switching.
The red curve is for soft switching.
Could be one example. Basically, it depends on your specific application, what your metrics are, what type of converter you're trying to design. So I'm just saying you'd have different curves for a different design approach. One of these curves is only valid for some assumptions on how you're going to design. Right. Say, hey, I'm designing with 10% current ripple and everything hard switching, then you can just plot this curve out. But if you start saying, well, I could be soft switching, I could be hard switching, it might be a buck or it might be a chew. All those things will have their own curves about how far they can go on this particular front. Kind of similar down here, rather than changing the topology of the switching approach, they're just changing the cooling technology. It's some curve power density versus switching frequency. Efficiency would be the same for either of these because they're only changing the thermal design. You see, you get some kind of curve about switching frequency versus power density for air cooled. With water cooled, you can do a little bit better. You get a separate curve for it. Efficiencies would both be the same, so it would kind of look like these blue and red lines that I drew here if we plotted them on the same axis. Okay.
Why the curve goes down and then up for the water cooled?
I don't know that. I have to go back and look at this paper again, whether that's either an artifact or their specific design had something that wanted to stay away from that switching frequency. I'm not sure on that. For the point I'm trying to make, ignore this. It's not there.
Hello, Dr. Kosnet.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I guess, since the switching frequency is multi-megahertz, I guess it might be the EMI filter just reduced because of the high frequency. I mean, could that be the design where the power density is increasing?
It could be a reason why it drops off, but to have that kind of spike there, I would expect to see something at that same frequency on the volume of the CM and DM filter here. But for their design, it's relatively constant slope. With EMI, you definitely get some jumps. The reason is if you're conforming to an EMI standard, it's not just continuous. It matters which harmonic falls under the standard when. Maybe a bit more detailed than we care about in this class, but like traditional DM EMI standards might start at 150 kilohertz. So if you're switching at 49 kilohertz, your third harmonic doesn't get regulated by the standard. If you switch at 50 kilohertz, your third harmonic is 150 and it gets regulated by the standard. So you'll suddenly I need to filter it a lot more. That's kind of some of these jumps are due to what actually falls within the standard. But I don't know if that can explain this dip that we're looking at down here, because you'd expect to see you had some resonance in your EMI filter that made it a real problem to operate at about 4 megahertz. That could be the reason why you see that, but I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, last one, I'm almost out of time here, so briefly. This isn't going to be, we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about magnetics design. But magnetics design is very important for pushing switching frequencies. Anyway, things like we generally know as we go to higher switching frequencies, we should be able to have smaller magnetic elements. But similar to what we talked about here, that falls apart at some point. Okay, we go higher and higher in switching frequency. Okay, we need smaller inductance, but as we push up there, we're going to have things like core loss, proximity loss, skin effect, eddy current and fringe effect losses of the magnetics become more significant. Generally, up in the mid to high megahertz range, it starts to turn around. These things are now much harder to design. They have to be really big elements, even though they're small inductances. They need to be real big to avoid proximity loss effects and have large air cores because all the core losses are way too high. So with magnetics, if we go higher and higher, they're going to become a significant limitation. Okay, and last one, I believe, these limitations I want to mention, not necessarily the last limitation, but the last one I'm going to talk about here, is, okay, like I said, as you start peeling away layers, you reveal, you incorporate one parasitic into your operation, the next most dominant parasitic becomes your biggest problem. So if we soft switch and we incorporate things like the drain to source capacitance into our operation, then maybe my drain inductance and my source inductance become the things that are really limiting how my switching energy, magnitude of my switching energy. As we go further and further, also the nonlinearities and kind of minor parasitic elements become more and more important, and it becomes a more and more monumental task to model all of this. Shown here is a reference from a group in Spain where they were trying to just do really good, accurate model of the switching behaviors of a MOSFET by incorporating all of these stray inductances, all of the capacitances, and then using a full transfer characteristic model for the MOSFET. So I should use the whole IDS versus VDS versus VGS curve to say, okay, start to turn on and it kind of comes out of cutoff and goes into saturation and then goes into triode later with a variable resistance. So model all of that, they're able to get results down here. See, this is about 10% error in power loss from their model versus what they actually measured on the circuit, which is not bad necessarily, but it's showing that, hey, even putting that much effort into the switching model of this MOSFET, they're going to end up with some error to do with, okay, how do you model all the nonlinearities and all the parasitics in this circuit? And if you really want to push things, the model becomes orders of magnitude more complex to really consider everything going on. So there's going to be some limitation in terms of what you can model accurately. You can take this model, do all the analysis, all the differential equations of it, and figure out how to minimize its switching losses. When you go to build it in the circuit, it's probably going to be a little bit off from where you want it. And if it's really dependent on that very particular optimization, the real circuit is off from that, you're not going to see those benefits. So there's some point where it becomes no longer worth it to put in all this effort in the analysis. Okay. Gone over on time. In there, have a good weekend. Pick up on Monday. This is kind of the end of my introduction to the course. We're going to dive into hard switching loss analysis and modeling on Monday. Thank you, everyone.